Thank you, Mark. Well, good evening, everybody. I'm Brandon. As you probably figured out, I'm also an alcoholic. Otherwise, I probably wouldn't be here at this time on a Sunday night. So I was thinking about where I would like to start. And when I first started reading the book, I started in the doctor's opinion by suggestion of my sponsor. And it was explained to me that, it's helpful rather than starting on page one to get some background there as well. And I was taught that it can help me understand my condition better, you know, as explained here, because some of the verbiage here is very useful. So I'd like to start off going there. And if you have a book and want to read along, it's XXV, or at least in the fourth edition. I don't know if it's different in any other ones. Cool. So we'll begin with the doctor's opinion. We of Alcoholics Anonymous believe that the reader will be interested in the medical estimate of the plan of recovery described in this book. Convincing testimony must surely come from medical men who have had experience with the sufferings of our members and have witnessed our return to health. A well-known doctor, chief physician at a nationally prominent hospital specializing in alcoholic and drug addiction, gave Alcoholics Anonymous this letter. To whom it may concern, I've specialized in the treatment of alcoholism for many years. In late 1934, I attended a patient who, though he had been a competent businessman of good earning capacity, was an alcoholic of a type I had come to regard as hopeless. In the course of his third treatment, he acquired certain ideas concerning a possible means of recovery. As part of his rehabilitation, he commenced to present his conception to other alcoholics, impressing upon them that they must do likewise with still others. This has become the basis of a rapidly growing fellowship of these men and their families. This man, and over 100 others, appear to have recovered. I personally know scores of cases who were of the type with whom other methods had failed completely. These facts appear to be of extreme medical importance. Because of the extraordinary possibilities of rapid growth inherent in this group, they may mark a new epoch in the annals of alcoholism. These men may well have a remedy for thousands of such situations. You may rely absolutely upon anything they say about themselves. So I'll pause there. I think my experience with this is that I saw people who I guess were heavy drinkers and whatever, and my uncle, for example, when I was trying to get sober, my life was an absolute disaster. I couldn't stop drinking, and I was just like laying on my parents' couch, trying to detox. And like my uncle came and he's like, you know, I used to have a drinking problem, but you just, you know, you have to put it down. It's so important, your family. And he laid out all of these, you know, reasons why you shouldn't drink and why you should, I guess, suffer through not drinking. And there are lots of people out there in the world that are like that, that if given a sufficient reason, they'll stop. You know, and it says it later in the book. And my experience is that that's different than what's described here, because it talks about people who are hopeless and the type with whom other methods had failed completely. And I couldn't understand that I was different than, I guess, other folks. And so to me, it's very important for me to grasp and sort of internalize the concept that I can't do what the so-called, I guess, normal, or even people who have like a drinking problem. And for those who are hearing the recording, I did some air quotes around drinking problem. And we all know what that means. So I'm a little bit different, you know, and if you're sitting here, I suspect you probably are too. I know that there are plenty of people who will like go to a detox or a rehab and feel sufficiently awful and then just not drink again. But that's not me. My experience is I get out of the hospital and within a short period of time, I'm drinking again, you know. My experience is that I crash my car and then like the next day I'm drinking again. And other methods don't work with me. And this, I think, is important because it establishes that immediately. So to start off that way, I think, is really important. So I'll go on from there. The physician who, at our request, gave us this letter has been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement which follows. In this statement, he confirms what we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe, that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. It did not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were in full flight from reality, or were outright mental defectives. These things were true to some extent, in fact, to a considerable extent with some of us, but we're sure that our bodies were sickened as well. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. The doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. As laymen, our opinion as to its soundness may, of course, mean little. But as ex-problem drinkers, we can say that his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. Though we work out our solution on the spiritual as well as an altruistic plane, we favor hospitalization for the alcoholic who is very jittery or befogged. More often than not, it's imperative that a man's brain be cleared before he's approached, as he has then a better chance of understanding and accepting what we have to offer. So I'll pause there. And this to me was really important. Interestingly enough, I read this and sort of grasped it at a superficial level, the understanding that once I put alcohol in my body, something abnormal happens to me. And that's what produces this reaction where I just can't stop once I start. It wasn't until maybe like a year or two into the rooms that I finally made this connection between that understanding and my sort of experiences with that and what it feels like and what my thought processes are like through that. And what I mean is somebody saying you have an allergy, like that's an observation. In other words, like somebody's looking at me and observing, like once you drink, this is the behavior I see. You know, it's obviously abnormal. We're observing that once you start, you don't stop. But for me to really connect that once I drink, this is what it feels like. It feels like all of a sudden, every reason I had for not drinking just evaporates and I can't remember them and I don't know why I was not drinking. In fact, I think I really want to have another one right now. That feeling to me and that like defective thought process, I didn't connect that as my abnormal reaction. You know? So what I'm saying is this to me is sort of an outward observance of what our behavior is. But for me it was really important to internalize what that feels like. And it sort of deepened my understanding of my illness. And also the idea that it really does center in my mind. You know, we're talking about this is how it works in the body and once I put it in my body. But the way that manifests for me is it completely hijacks my own mental faculties. And it's like it turns my own will against me, if that makes sense. It's like the will that was resisting the drink suddenly becomes driving me towards it. It's like all of a sudden this sort of like seesaw goes the other direction and it's crazy. All it took was putting one drink on the seesaw and boom, it's over, you know? So that was really important to me. I'd like to go on from there. Let's move on to where the doctor writes. The doctor writes, "The subject presented in this book seems to me to be of paramount importance to those afflicted with alcoholic addiction. I say this after many years' experience as medical director of one of the oldest hospitals in the country treating alcoholic and drug addiction. There was, therefore, a sense of real satisfaction when I was asked to contribute a few words on the subject, which is covered in such masterly detail in these pages. We doctors have realized for a long time that some form of moral psychology was of urgent importance to alcoholics, but its application presented difficulties beyond our conception. What with our ultra-modern standards, our scientific approach to everything, we're perhaps not well equipped to apply the powers of good that lie outside our synthetic knowledge. Many years ago, one of the leading contributors to this book came under our care in this hospital, and while here, he acquired some ideas which he put into practical application at once." I'm going to pause there and just say that putting the ideas into practical application is something that I never tried until I came into the rooms of AA. I always sort of thought that understanding something was the key, and once I understand it, then I'm good. It wasn't until I actually started to do what was in here and practically apply it that I got some results. And I don't know if you guys can relate to this, but I hated practicing anything. I thought I was supposed to just immediately be good at something. You know, I was never the person who would start something and suck at it and then work hard and get better. I'd be like, if I'm good at this, great. And if I'm not, then must not be for me. The idea of like learning something and then doing practical application to like actually get better at doing it just completely eluded me. So this is, for me, one of the important things is, you know, later on they say the spiritual life is not a theory, we have to live it. To me, this is just like foreshadowing of that, you know? So I'll move on from there. Later, he requested the privilege of being allowed to tell his story to the other patients here, and with some misgiving, we consented. The cases we have followed through have been most interesting. In fact, many of them are amazing. The unselfishness of these men as we've come to know them, the entire absence of profit motive, and their community spirit is indeed inspiring to one who has labored long and wearily in this alcoholic field. They believe in themselves, and still more in the power which pulls chronic alcoholics back from the gates of death. So, I'm just going to mention something that I thought was kind of funny. Last night I was watching TV with my son, and we got an ad for some, like, I guess it's like a rehab, but, you know, it seemed like one of those where they say, come stay here for a couple weeks and you'll be cured and, you know, you won't be an alcoholic anymore, that type of place. And I started chuckling at it, and I thought it was hilarious. And he was asking me, he's like, well, you know, what about that stuff? And I explained to him, like, where I go, it's free. And it's as long as you want to be a member, you can be a member. It's not like I pay somebody money and they let me participate in their thing for a couple weeks. And then if you didn't get it, oh, well, I guess you got to pay again next time after your life goes to hell again. You know, I explained to him that, you know, where I go, it's free and you can attend for as long as you want. And to me, that's really, I think, foreign in general. The idea that you can be a member of or even if it's not a member, just have something that actually works as a positive enhancement for your life and then which radiates out to the people around you in your life, and you can participate and it's free. There's no profit motive. It's unselfish, you know, and we're there to help each other. That's completely foreign. Having not really grasped it, I tried to explain to him, but it's almost impossible to explain because it doesn't seem to exist anywhere else. You know, anywhere else I've gone, even in other like groups and such that are ostensibly for helping other people and being of service, there's always some type of motive there that is not our primary purpose of helping somebody else. There's always like, you know, we want to grow our group and recruit more people, or we want people to pat us on the back and talk about how great our group is. And we're not like that. We're anonymous. Nobody, we don't want anybody to know who we are. We just want to be helpful. And so it struck me that this really is something that is like so incredibly rare. I don't know of any other organization that does that, where we don't want any credit. We don't want anything. We're not out there seeking to grow our ranks and like recruit more people. We're just like, hey, if you want to come here and you need help, then great, we'll help you. And if not, then wish you well. I hope you do well. You know, it's, I don't know if it's unique, but it feels like it is. You know, just because I don't know any other examples of it. So it struck me as reading that people who have not participated have a difficult time understanding it because it seems outlandish, you know? So I just wanted to pause there for a minute and talk about that, but let's go on from there. Of course, an alcoholic ought to be freed from his physical craving for liquor, and this often requires a definite hospital procedure before psychological measures can be a maximum benefit. We believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol in these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. Once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. And I think that for anybody in this room, that probably resonates quite well. I know that for me, towards the end, I had lost my confidence and my reliance upon things human, and my problems had piled up on me and became astonishingly difficult to solve. And it's funny how that goes, because it's like the mental, physical, and spiritual energy that I would need to solve my problems just wasn't there. You know, all I wanted to do at the end was just die. And I didn't have the ability to recover without being sort of infused with energy from you guys until I could learn to access that power on my own. You know, but on my own, I had nothing. I remember I was like seeing psychiatrist and taking medication, and I was seeing a therapist, and I'd be drunk writing myself notes at like 2 o'clock in the morning, like, this medicine probably isn't working. And like, yeah, of course. You know, if you're drinking all night, your medicine probably isn't going to work. Not only because of the alcohol, but the lack of sleep and just the rest of the insanity going on. Not to mention I was trying to use psychiatric medicine on a spiritual illness, which just doesn't work. You know, and I think of it like this. Like, conventional problem solving says that there's a series of, I guess, questions, issues, tasks that need to be dealt with, and then the problem will be resolved. And what I learned here is that may apply to like conventional problems, but this is not like that for me. My experience is that if I take the series of actions in this book, which seem to have nothing at all to do with my problem, you know, they seem completely unrelated. But if I do that, it's almost like it bypasses all of the conventional problem solving and just takes me right to a solution. You know, it's like if you're trying to do like one of those little mazes that they give to kids, like you just drag your pen until you find the exit. This just takes my pen and puts it right at the exit. It bypasses all of the conventional strategy. And it's difficult to understand if you haven't experienced it. So, you know, I guess I had to be absolutely destroyed before I was willing to do something that didn't make sense, right? So, once I got that, my problems, which were astonishingly difficult to solve, seemed to kind of get solved on their own. And to this day, problems which I think are astonishingly difficult to solve frequently seem to just get resolved on their own, as long as I just try to be of service and do the right action and don't put my own self-centered motives ahead of whatever God would have me be, which I don't always know, but I don't always know what God would have me be, but I always know what He would not have me be. Which is a lot easier, you know? So, I'll move on from there before I go off on a tangent. So, frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. The message which can interest and hold these alcoholic people must have depth and weight. In nearly all cases, their ideals must be grounded in a power greater than themselves if they're to recreate their lives. That is such a succinct explanation. When I was in an outpatient program, there was a conversation about like, what if you could take a pill and it would allow you to drink socially? And the facilitator of the group, which I don't know if he was an actual therapist, whatever, it was the counselor, made a comment that if such a pill existed and you offered it to a member of Alcoholics Anonymous who's actually done the 12 steps, they would laugh at you and tell you to shove the pill up your rear end. And I was like, that's ridiculous. Why would you do that? You know, this can solve your problem. And then coming here and working through this process, what I realized is that it wouldn't solve the problem, because the problem isn't the amount I drink. That the amount I was drinking was causing problems, but that's not it. And interestingly enough, I knew back then that I had other problems than the drinking. And I was like, well, if I could just be okay on the inside, then maybe, you know, then I would be good. But I didn't understand what that meant. You know, so this talking about the message needs to have depth and weight, and the ideals grounded in a power greater than themselves. If somebody gave me that pill today, I would tell them to shove it up their rear end, because the fact that I have this life, I wouldn't even say that I recreated a life. I would say that I created a brand new life. Up until the point that I came into here, I really didn't have one. You know, any life that I had been absolutely burned to the ground, and out of the ashes grew a new life. It wasn't recreated. It was just brand new. But yeah, definitely the ideals grounded in a power greater than themselves. It's so much better than the sort of superficial message of don't drink and you'll be fine. So moving on from there, if any feel that as psychiatrists directing a hospital for alcoholics, we appear somewhat sentimental, let them stand with us a while on the firing line. See the tragedies, the despairing wives, the little children. Let the solving of these problems become a part of their daily work and even their sleeping moments. And the most cynical will not wonder that we've accepted and encouraged this movement. We feel, after many years of experience, that we've found nothing which has contributed more to the rehabilitation of these men than the altruistic movement now growing up among them. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that, while they admit it's injurious, they cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience a sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks which they see others taking with impunity. After they've succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful, with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over, and unless the person can experience an entire psychic change, there's very little hope of his recovery. Pausing there. So, I remember being in therapy, and the doctor that I was seeing knew that I drank way too much, probably because I was like coming into his office at 10 o'clock in the morning and I was already blasted by that point. You know, and I was telling him, oh, I just drank a lot last night. And he's like, you stink like alcohol. I'm like, well, I drank a lot last night. And he knew I was already wrecked by like 10 o'clock in the morning. But I lied to him a lot. But anyway, the point of where I'm going with this is, he said to me something along the lines of, why don't you have like two drinks? And I remember saying, why? And I didn't have the vocabulary to explain at the time what I was saying, but what I was saying is, it's not going to do what I want it to do. You know, what I want is the effect. I'm not drinking because I want to taste Crystal Palace vodka, you know, $11 for the jug of it. It's certainly, I'm not drinking that for the flavor, I assure you. For me, it was strictly about the effect, you know, and two drinks wouldn't get me there. And what I was thinking at the time is like, why would anyone do that? And I got to be honest with you, to this day, I don't understand why anybody would have one or two drinks. I mean, I get that there's people who maybe enjoy the flavor of whatever they're drinking, but nobody drinks cheap crap to enjoy the flavor of it. So I don't understand why anyone would do that. Because you're not getting that effect. Now, there is one thing that I was taught which helps make sense of that. And that is that the effect that I get from from drinking that I want, that I'm willing to sacrifice my life for, essentially, and that two drinks won't get me to, that's not the same effect that the average non-alcoholic person gets. It's not just that when I put alcohol in my body, I, you know, seemingly can't stop. It's also that what it's doing for me is apparently different than the average person. You know, the average person will drink and maybe they'll feel relaxed. And if they drink too much, they don't feel fantastic. They feel nauseous and tired. And I didn't realize that. I hung out with people who drank like I did. And I thought that what happened to me drinking was what everybody got. And it mystified me. Why would you want two drinks if it's not going to give you that product? But in hindsight, I think about it and I'm like, well, if you have two drinks and you feel kind of relaxed, but then you have a third and you just want to throw up, it makes sense. And within that context, like, I get it. It means that I am abnormal in a variety of ways. And it's not just the way I drink, but it's also what happens to me when I drink. And I've seen that with a lot of people who are ostensibly normal. They drink normally. I don't know if they're normal in all other respects. But I'll give you an example. Like my sister, she does not drink the way I do at all. And I remember, like, at family parties and stuff, I would be outpacing her dramatically with the drinking, and I just could not understand. And I'm like, does she have, like, great control or something? And the reality is, no, she's just, what happens to me doesn't happen to her. So, in other words, when it says that, you know, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol, I think that that may be true, but I think that for me and for probably the majority of other alcoholics, the effect that we get is much more impactful, pleasant, whatever you want to call it, to the point where we are willing to sacrifice for it. I know I was. And man, I heard somebody say once that it took me a long time to see what alcohol was doing to me, because what it was doing for me was so much more important. And I was like, wow, yeah, that's true. But the thing that got me when I first read this is when it says they're restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks which they see others taking with impunity. I remember reading those words, restless, irritable, and discontented, and I was like, oh my God, that is so spot on. That's exactly how I feel. And I don't know if I felt restless, irritable, and discontented because that was just my natural state at that point, because I was so damaged mentally and spiritually, or if it was just because I was so absolutely miserable that I was not drinking at the moment. But I think those are really two sides of the same coin. You know? Because the not drinking is because I was miserable and I just wanted to. Probably the best way I ever heard that described is somebody said, when I'm sober, I don't like it. You know, and that basically was where I was at. You know, restless, irritable, and discontented. I didn't like it. I didn't want life sober. But it's also my experience that the rest of the paragraph is very true as well. You know, talking about after they succumb to the desire again, a phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful. And all of these things, I didn't feel fortunate when I first came in and was destroyed and read this book and was like, God, every single thing in here is me. I must be really sick. But I look back and I feel grateful for that, because I didn't have the sort of excuses and differentiation that would have allowed me to compare myself out the door. I was sick enough that I really did relate to almost everything in here. Especially like the stages of the spree and whatnot, and being irritable and restless. Like walking in the door, being drunk again, and my mother, like, the look of disappointment the look of disappointment that she gave me. You know, I don't think anybody who's not an alcoholic understands that look and what it does as it sort of damages our spirit as we know that we've disappointed somebody again, not because we wanted to, because we just couldn't do anything different. Feeling remorseful and not wanting to drink again, but it's like, it's going to happen sooner or later, right? Why? Because the alternative is being restless, irritable, and discontented. I can't survive like that forever. Could you, right? Nobody can. So, little hope until you're experiencing entire psychic change. Yeah. Yeah. Not until I had a psychic change did I get any durable recovery. Anything was just tenuous and very short term. So let's go on from there. On the other hand, and strange as this may seem to those who do not understand, once the psychic changes occurred, the same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol, the only effort necessary being that required to follow a few simple rules. I chuckle a little bit there because, again, the doctor's doing what doctors do. He's observing. It looks to him like we have the ability to control our desire. That's not my experience. My experience is that the desire for alcohol went away. I wasn't controlling it. It was just removed. You know, as the book talks about later in like the 10-step promises, it's not like we're fighting. It's just gone, you know? So I think it's interesting to hear about how the outward observer, the doctor, describes this stuff, the way it looks. And I relate strongly to when it's described from the inside out by the alcoholics in the book later on. So let's move on from there. Men have cried out to me in sincere and despairing appeal. Doctor, I cannot go on like this. I have everything to live for. I must stop, but I cannot. You must help me. Faced with this problem, if a doctor is honest with himself, he must sometimes feel his own inadequacy. Although he gives all that is in him, it often is not enough. One feels that something more than human power is needed to produce the essential psychic change. Though the aggregate of recoveries resulting from psychiatric effort is considerable, we physicians must admit we have made little impression upon the problem as a whole. Many types do not respond to the ordinary psychological approach. I think an interesting aside for that is that there are people who, I guess, respond to the ordinary psychological, psychiatric approach, even to this day. And so what I take away from that is there are people who come through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous and they'll be at a couple meetings and then they'll decide that this isn't for them and they'll go back out and they'll meet with their doctor for, I don't know, however long they need to meet with their doctor for, and then they never drink again. And the thing is that it's almost impossible to know before you know. Meaning that if I am drinking all the time, I don't know if that's going to be me or if I'm going to be the guy that these things don't work with. So in my case, like I said, I did try going to a psychiatrist and a psychologist. I thought that that was going to work. So it's almost by process of elimination, that I came here and that I guess a lot of us do because we try like other things first. I don't know about you guys, but I didn't want to come here. I didn't. I wanted any other thing other than this because I saw that there was like God written in the steps and the whole thing sounded hokey to me and I thought it was ridiculous. I thought I was like too smart and too like logical for that. But the bottom line is there are people that don't respond to any approach except for the spiritual approach. And it seems like I'm one of them. But interestingly enough, and I'm going to borrow a phrase I heard from somebody else once before too. I love doing that. I love borrowing other people's words, you know, and just kind of dropping them here, spreading the stuff I've heard, and hopefully somebody else likes it too. So one that I heard is that this spiritual illness that we have is the only illness that we're aware of where when you properly treat it, it leaves the sufferer in a better position than if they never had the illness in the first place. And that's my experience. My experience is that after going through the 12 steps and, you know, continuing to live on that path, my life is so much different, and I feel just so much better in general than before I started drinking. So like the person I was before I started to now, it's like the value that this has added to my life is so much that, you know, like I said, if somebody offered me that pill, I'd tell them what to do with it. Because it couldn't give me everything else that I've gotten out of this. In fact, there are plenty of people who are not alcoholic who seek what we have, that want to find meaningful, purposeful life. One that allows us to find peace and be useful, you know. And there's millions, probably billions of people out there who want that. And we're forced into that way of life, like against our own will. I didn't want that, but I had no other choice. So, yeah. For me, I'm oddly grateful that the ordinary psychological approach didn't work for me. And I thought people were crazy when they said things like, I'm a grateful alcoholic. I didn't know what they meant. I thought they meant that they were grateful to not be drinking, or they were grateful that their life wasn't on fire anymore. But it's like, no, I'm grateful that I have something that hurt me bad enough that it opened my eyes, my mind, and my heart to a new way of life, which is so far beyond anything that I could have imagined was possible. Yeah. And I think that if I had responded to an ordinary psychological approach, I would have shortchanged myself, you know? So going on from there, I do not hold with those who believe that alcoholism is entirely a problem of mental control. I've had many men who had, for example, worked on a period of months on some problem or business deal, which was to be settled on a certain date favorably to them. They took a drink a day or so prior to the date, and then the phenomenon of craving at once became paramount to all of their interests, so the important appointment was not met. These men were not drinking to escape, they were drinking to overcome a craving beyond their mental control. There are many situations which arise out of the phenomenon of craving, which cause men to make the supreme sacrifice rather than continue to fight. Definitely true for me. I presume that if you're sitting here, you probably also have a bunch of experiences where you get drunk by mistake. That's one of my favorite things. Like, I got drunk by accident. I meant to have like two or three. I didn't mean to, you know, and that happens all the time. Like, for example, I was going to school or to work or whatever the thing was, or I was the designated driver. And, you know, I had one or two, and then I had like a lot more, which was not planned. But that's what I get out of this, is I just don't have the ability to control how much I'm going to drink on any given day. And unfortunately, a lot of situations arise out of that, which caused me to want to make the supreme sacrifice too, rather than continue to fight. Like I said, at the end, I just wanted to die. The person I had become was just so untrustworthy and so cynical and so miserable. You know, I wanted to die really bad. I was thinking about how I was going to kill myself in a way that wouldn't hurt and would not like devastate my parents. That's what I was trying to do. Couldn't find a way to do that, but that was my plan, was eventually find that way. And again, a lot of that is because of situations that arose from the way I was drinking and the way I was living as a consequence. So, the classification of alcoholics seems most difficult, and in much detail is outside the scope of this book. There are, of course, the psychopaths who are emotionally unstable. We're all familiar with this type. They're always going on the wagon for keeps. They're over remorseful and make many resolutions, but never a decision. There's the type of man who's unwilling to admit that he cannot take a drink. He plans various ways of drinking. He changes his brand or environment. There's the type who always believes that after being entirely free from alcohol for a period of time, he can take a drink without danger. There's the manic depressive type, who is perhaps the least understood by his friends, and about whom a whole chapter could be written. Then there are types entirely normal in every respect, except in the effect alcohol has upon them. They're often able, intelligent, friendly people. All these and many others have one symptom in common. They cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. This phenomenon, as we've suggested, may be the manifestation of an allergy which differentiates these people and sets them apart as a distinct entity. It's never been, by any treatment with which we're familiar, permanently eradicated. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. I don't know about you folks, but I actually relate to pretty much all of them, except for the entirely normal in every respect. You know, like I've got a little bit of the other ones all in me. The planning various ways, changing the brand and the environment, thinking that I can drink safely after being away from it for a period, and having... I was, by the way, when I was new, I was diagnosed by my psychiatrist as being bipolar 1. And what I realized now after many years is that it was a misdiagnosis, because I was just having wild mood swings all the time, because I had damaged my brain so badly through all the drinking and probably all the drugging of years past as well. But I was presenting with symptoms of what they called manic depressive, which is now called bipolar. So I relate to pretty much everything in that paragraph. The only thing that I don't relate to is the being entirely normal in every respect, because I felt different than everybody. The last thing I felt was normal, you know? So going on from there, you know what? I'll just say one other thing. They say the only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. I didn't like that idea. And I think the interesting thing is I didn't want abstinence, like I said, because I'd come to rely upon alcohol for basically everything. The idea of entire abstinence didn't occur to me until I was finally like done. Up until that point, I always thought that there would be some way that I would figure out to drink normally at like maybe weddings and funerals and holidays and any other good excuse I could think of. But, you know, the idea of just never drinking again ever, like I thought like it, maybe if I don't drink for a couple of years, eventually I could become normal again. Entire abstinence was never something that was on my radar until I finally got, I guess, willing enough to consider that type of thing. But, he says, this immediately precipitates us into a seething cauldron of debate. Much has been written pro and con, but among physicians, the general opinion seems to be that most chronic alcoholics are doomed. What is the solution? Perhaps I can best answer this by relating one of my experiences. About 1 year prior to this experience, a man was brought in to be treated for chronic alcoholism. He had but partially recovered from a gastric hemorrhage and seemed to be a case of pathological mental deterioration. He had lost everything worthwhile in life and was only living, one might say, to drink. He frankly admitted and believed that for him there was no hope. Following the elimination of alcohol, there was found to be no permanent brain injury. He accepted the plan outlined in this book. 1 year later, he called to see me and I experienced a very strange sensation. I knew the man by name and partly recognized his features, but there all resemblance ended. From a trembling, despairing, nervous wreck had emerged a man brimming over with self-reliance and contentment. I talked with him for some time, but was not able to bring myself to feel that I had known him before. To me, he was a stranger, and so he left me. A long time has passed with no return to alcohol. So this, to me, is just sort of a description of the entire psychic change that they mentioned earlier, and which has been my experience too. Like, the person that I was growing up or drinking, when I describe to people, or even if I show them pictures of who I used to be when I was drinking, people are like, no way, you wouldn't do that. And, you know, and I describe, like, you know, I spun my car around and crashed in on the parkway, and then I fled the scene of the accident, and I was like trying to change my flat tire, but I couldn't do it, and I kept like bashing my knuckles into the ground as I was turning the, and people hear that kind of stuff, and unless it's people who are like friends in the rooms, like people who I know outside of here who have never seen me like that, it's incomprehensible to them, because the person I am today would never do something like that. But who I was, you know, it's just so different. I'm fundamentally not the same that I used to be. And it would do me well to remember that as I go through life and I see other people, that I have absolutely no room to judge anybody else, because who I am today is not the product of, you know, good character, hard work, or dedication. It's strictly just a gift that I got from following the directions that people gave me. You know, and sometimes, you know, one of my kids will lie about something and be selfish, and my thought is like, oh God, how could they do that type of thing? And then I look and I'm like, I was way worse. I was so much worse. You know, when I was 15, I was absolutely a disaster. You know, and I was like drinking already by time, you know, and these guys are, they're good kids, but I'm looking at things through today's frame of reference by the way I behave today, and I'm looking at things like as if I was always like that, which is so untrue. So I find it very funny that they talk about in this paragraph how he couldn't bring himself to feel that he knew him. He was a stranger, and when I tell people about the way I used to be, it feels like, to them, that's a stranger. I didn't realize the time that it was. It is 7:33, so I think that's it for today. Let's stop there. Thank you.